Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lance Armstrong was a superstar athlete and something more, a symbol of perseverance and triumph over cancer. And something more, it turns out, after all, a doper. Last night, the world saw his confession to Oprah. He admitted to doping. She asked if he had felt what he did was wrong.
At the time?
Mm-hmm.
No.
It did not even feel wrong.
No. It's scary.
Did you feel bad about it?
No. Even scarier.
Did you feel in any way that you were cheating?
No. The scariest.
Lance Armstrong was hard on people who tried to call out his doping years. He was also a global symbol of hope. So what now? This hour On Point, we're looking at the lessons of Lance Armstrong in a pumped-up age. You can join the conversation. What did you hear in the interview? What do you see in this story? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's listen to some more of those denials over the years. Lance Armstrong repeatedly denying doping charges. Here he was, one among many, many, many denials here in 2004.
We're sick and tired of these allegations, and we're going to do everything we can to fight them. They're absolutely untrue.
And here in 2005, on the Larry King Show, Lance Armstrong looked straight into the camera and again proclaimed he was clean.
I've said it for 7 years. I've said it for longer than 7 years. I have never doped. If you consider my situation, a guy who comes back from arguably a death sentence, why would I then enter into a sport and dope myself up and risk my life again? That's crazy. I would never do that. No way.
And here, when Lance Armstrong went to court against an insurance company that refused to pay him performance bonuses, he was deposed and, in his testimony, denied doping and drug transfusion. Here's part of that testimony from an Australian TV documentary.
I've never taken performance-enhancing drugs.
Okay, how could that have happened?
That was my point. It's not just simply you don't recall.
How many times do I have to say it?
I'm just trying to make sure your testimony is clear.
Well, if it can't be any clearer than I've never taken drugs, then incidents like that could never have happened.
Okay.
How clear is that?
Well, here was a little bit of the interview last night. Lance Armstrong and Oprah. Oprah started her interview with Lance Armstrong with a string of yes and no questions.
Yes or no? Did you ever take banned substances to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
Yes or no? Was one of those banned substances EPO?
Yes.
Did you ever blood dope or use blood transfusions to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
Did you ever use any other banned substances like testosterone, cortisone, or human growth hormone?
Yes.
Yes or no? In all seven of your Tour de France victories, did you ever take banned substances or blood dope?
Yes.
In your opinion, was it humanly possible to win the Tour de France without doping 7 times in a row?
Not in my opinion.
Not in his opinion, but he did dope, and he did win. And now those wins stripped from Lance Armstrong there with Oprah last night. You can join us today, 800-423-8255. What do you finally take from this story? On the front of sports, on the front of honesty, on the front of life and survivor stories. 800-423-TALK is our number. With us right now from New York is Daniel Coyle. He's co-author with Olympic cycling gold medalist Tyler Hamilton, who admitted to doping with Lance Armstrong, of the new book, The Secret Race, Inside the Hidden World of the Tour de France, Doping Cover-Ups and Winning at All Costs. He's also author of Lance Armstrong's War. He's a contributing editor to Outside Magazine and knows Lance Armstrong in the cycling world pretty much inside and out. Daniel Coyle, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Culver City, California is Karen Sternheimer. She's looked deeply at our celebrity culture and its implications. Professor of sociology at the University of California. She's author of Celebrity Culture and the American Dream, Stardom and Social Mobility. Karen Sternheimer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Daniel Coyle, you know this story, this man, those around him, the allegations that have been out there for so long. You know all that so well. What's your response to what we all heard last night?
It was breathtaking. It was stunning. It was stunning. You know, we can look at it through a few different lenses, but ultimately you had, you know, we knew the facts. We knew, you know, in the book, The Secret Race, and in other work, in the USADA report, the 1,000 pages of evidence that came down in October, we knew most of these facts. But to see Armstrong, the psychological drama of him saying those words and seeing his face as he said those just simple yes was stunning. And it creates a real series of questions. I mean, you know, obviously, where does he go from here? But these larger questions about how did this happen? How do we diagnose this sort of car crash in a way to make sure that it doesn't happen again? And the story is, you know, Lance is dominating it, but the story is, in fact, much, much bigger than Armstrong.
We want to look at all of that. But first, because you know it, you certainly know it better than I, better than most of us, and there's more to come. We know that from his conversations with Oprah. Mm-hmm. But in what you saw last night, how close to the full truth have we come?
10%, maybe? You know, he did not give. He admitted, and this is what happened. This is the fascinating bit. He admitted a bit. You know, there are so many more details. You know, and the truth is really in these details. This was a massive secret life. In The Secret Race, we chronicle, you know, they were hiding blood bags in dog kennels and putting blankets over them and smuggling them into the race. They were doing transfusions laying on the bus. They would fake a breakdown during the Tour de France and give transfusions to all the team. Lance would lay on the floor and take his blood bag. There was dope in a secret refrigerator in his apartment he shared with Sheryl Crow. There was a secret doctor, Swiss bank accounts. This was this fantastic, huge, crazy scheme that he's only begun to scratch the surface on. So he's not giving the full thing. He's also resisting. There were many moments last night where he pushed back and said, well, that's not true. I wasn't really the kingpin. I did the 2009 and 2010 tours clean, all of which are demonstrably untrue. You know, he's still holding on to that. Now, we can look at that one of two ways. We can say he's a liar. He's being the same guy. Or in my experience in writing the book and spending 2 years with Tyler Hamilton, who was right next to Lance for this most of this era, you can see it as part of the painful psychology of admission. You know, he has held on to this lie so tightly for so long that there's no way he can flip a switch and suddenly be transparent. And so what we saw last night was an important sort of first begrudging step in the right direction. And there were moments where there was genuine reflection, it felt like. It felt some authenticity in there. So it's something that potentially could be built on if you do have hope for the future.
I want to look at that. But before we go there, and I want to look at the celebrity pressure on a man like this with you, Karen, but you say 10% of the truth maybe last night. I mean, that's not a whole lot. What about, did we hear, see things last night that were the opposite of truth, that were still lies? I mean, the USADA, Anti-Doping Agency, I believe their conclusion was that his cycling accomplishments were the result of, quoting them here, the most sophisticated, professional, and successful doping program the sport has ever seen. But we heard him last night in response to Oprah saying, well, yeah, I did that, but not much, but not too much, not much of that. Is that a lie again?
It's one of the inevitable lies when you come out of a toxic culture like that. Yes, that is not true. He also, you know, another one that I would point out is his claim that he, when he did his comeback in 2009 and 2010, that he did it clean. You know, scientists have looked at his blood values for that, and they've determined that there's a 1 in a million chance that they would occur naturally. They say it's clear signs of blood doping during those tours, which would also make psychological sense. If you win the tour 7 times by cheating, would you ever go back and get rid of that advantage? So no, he's not telling the complete truth. But the reason I'd emphasize again is because this is a very deep, big, huge secret, and you can't just flip a switch. The lying, the sort of slow walk toward the truth is part of this process. It's what I saw with Tyler Hamilton in doing The Secret Race. It's what we see with other guys who have made their admissions. There's no way to sort of magically begin to tell the truth. And the riveting part of it was that it was happening there in live. You know, he yeah. this was like the most painful therapy session ever, except that a million people were in the room.
And we all saw it. Karen Sternheimer, it's painful for anybody when you're an icon, a celebrity of the scale of Lance Armstrong. What's the dynamic as he's sitting there with those cameras running in a hotel in Austin, Texas, letting loose at least 10%, Daniel says.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that's only 10%. I think Oprah is really glad to hear you say that, Daniel, because I think people will come back and watch tonight because of that. You know, celebrities' images are very carefully crafted. And I think Armstrong's was unusually carefully crafted for a cyclist, especially, and maybe even an athlete in general. And so to have that unravel, you could see all of the work that he had done to try and create this persona that was not real, unraveling before our eyes. And so I think that's part of the drama that people are now feasting on today. He wasn't who he said he was. He kind of helped develop, and even one of the clips you played, he was saying, I beat cancer. Why would I do this to myself? And so he was reinstating himself as this kind of superhuman character. And I think it's really hard to pedal back from that, too. You know, forgive the pun there.
Yeah, yeah. I want to look at that and much more. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Here was the sound in stage 17 of 20 in the Tour de France in 2004. Lance Armstrong prevailing in the final moments.
Armstrong is coming with an incredible rush, and Clode has realized it too late. Is there any stopping Lance Armstrong in this Tour de France? And the answer is no, there is not, because Ulrich has just seen his teammate beaten on the line by fractions of an inch. That was unbelievable.
Boy, those were big days, and there were many more. Seven wins, a record seven wins of the Tour de France. Last night, Lance Armstrong on with Oprah saying, yes, I doped, after years and years of denying. In 2011, his teammate Tyler Hamilton told CBS anchor Scott Pelley how he and some of the U.S. Postal Service team led by Armstrong used banned drugs, including EPO and testosterone. Pelley asked him directly about Armstrong then.
What did you actually witness?
I saw it in his refrigerator. I saw him inject it more than one time.
You saw Lance Armstrong inject EPO?
Yeah, like we all did. Like I did many, many times.
But it was such a big story, such a moving story, given the cancer that he suffered. Here, the Tour de France awards ceremony in 2003, with Lance Armstrong waving to the crowd in the background, an announcer marvels at his win.
He was told he had testicular cancer. Who would have thought at that time that he would come back, not just to get on a bike again, not just to be able to race again, not just to be able to ride the Tour de France, but to win it.
But to win it, here was Jon Stewart weighing in on the Oprah interview as we all anticipated it earlier this week.
I believed in you, Lance Armstrong. I shelled out a dollar for a rubber bracelet that I have somewhere in my house for you. I did it for you.
Jon Stewart makes a joke, but a lot of people did look at this man and think, wow, look at what you can do, even with cancer. Daniel Coyle is with us, author of The Secret Race and Lance Armstrong's War. Karen Sternheimer is with us from Culver City, California, author of Celebrity Culture and the American Dream. Daniel Coyle, who says we heard maybe 10% of the truth last night. And Daniel, you know well from your work with Tyler Hamilton and others, I mean, people really paid a price for Lance's denial of truth here. We've got listeners writing in. One says, you know, let's clarify. He not only threatened people, he destroyed careers and businesses. In his cycling team, you're either with the doping of the team or you're against him. He goes and, you know, lists people who he kind of brought low with his years of denial, Daniel.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's how he approached bike racing, and that's how he approached his life. His brain works in a very binary way. He looks at a situation. He determines everything's black and white. Either you're a friend and an ally, or you're his worst enemy. There's no gray area, and that's the way he operated. And when someone threatened him, He went at them with all he had, and he had a lot to go with. This is a man who has lunches with the president. This is a man who's got a lot of money and a lot of lawyers. But what's interesting to me is the way that the two sides of his personality, and we can think of it that way, you sort of did have, the, as he said last night, the humanitarian and the jerk in the same sort of body. And when you look at the psychology of cheating, what happens is when you do something good, you sort of give yourself tacit permission to do something bad. So the cancer activity that he did wasn't a mask so much for what he did as it was the engine for what he did. Because when he did something good in the world, it gave him permission to go farther and darker into the areas of doping. So it was this strange sort of dynamic that no other cyclist had, where he sort of gave himself permission because he wasn't just cycling for himself. He was winning this for millions of people who were suffering from cancer. And so he was able to be more and more aggressive. It was this sort of weird dysfunction, but it ended up functioning quite well for him until suddenly it didn't.
The humanitarian and the jerk, Oprah asked him in the interview that aired last night, were you a bully?
Yeah, I was a bully.
Tell me how you were a bully.
I was a bully in the sense that that I tried to control the narrative. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't like what somebody said, and for whatever reasons in my own head, whether I viewed that as somebody being disloyal or as a friend turning on you or whatever, I tried to control that and said that, you know, that's a lie, they're liars.
That's a lie, they're liars. That was Lance Armstrong then. We've got lots of callers. Spokane, Washington, Dustin is calling. Hi, Dustin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. I wanted to, Lance's effect on me is kind of unique. About 2.5 years ago, I became blind, and within that 24 hours of becoming blind, my mother had fallen into a coma. And the after effects, nonetheless, you know, obviously depression, and during this time I had watched that movie, the movie Dodgeball, which I've seen many times, and Lance is at the end of it, you know, trying to bring back some good in the movie, you know, a plot point. But anyway, I tried using that to my advantage and just become happier again and just in general, but now, literally and metaphorically, I can't, you know, look up to him in any way. But
is it hard to lose? Is it hard, Dustin, to lose a source of what sounds for you was inspiration in Lance Armstrong?
Well, in a way, I took Lance and everything else in my life that's kind of a negative thing, anything painful, and I turned it around, and it's now actually a fuel in a way, just an unstoppable fuel that I use. And Lance, in a way, is, you know, hey, if he's going to turn something so positive into a negative, I just might as well use that as well. But I'm just saying that also other people, they just can't look at that movie the same way anymore either.
That movie and this story. Dustin, I appreciate your call. I mean, a lot of people did find inspiration here. John Stewart mocks the yellow bracelets, but a lot of people wore them, often wore them for their own lives or for people whose lives they really cared about. Here last night, Armstrong was saying he had, for a time, constructed the perfect narrative.
This story was so perfect for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that as I try to take myself out of the situation and I look at it. You overcome the disease. You win the Tour de France 7 times. You have a happy marriage. You have children. I mean, it's just this mythic, perfect story.
Yes.
And it wasn't true.
Karen Sternheimer in California, does the Lance Armstrong story sort of pin the needle for iconic status and, you know, very polar opposite truth in many ways?
Absolutely. I think that all celebrities in some way serve some kind of purpose, even if the purpose is just to make fun of them. And he served, I think, a very unique purpose because he offered a sense of actually transcendence, not just over cancer, but over something that might seem to be humanly impossible with winning 7 times. So I think when we find out that that's a fraud, it really challenges this notion of authenticity. And we don't expect that much from celebrities, but we do condemn them if they seem to be fraudulent, if they're not who they are setting us up to believe that they are.
And certainly There is so much of that out there right now. Though the allegations raised by Daniel Coyle and Tyler and others for such a long time surely raise doubts if you're paying attention. Kevin in Philadelphia is calling. Kevin, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am a former bicycle race mechanic. I was one of those guys that you see at the back of the race on a motorcycle with wheels and taking care of the racers. In the sport of cycling, those of us that have worked in the sport, there's a culture that we've all known all along that doping exists in our sport since the 1950s. It's just part of the culture of the sport. I'm not saying that it's right. I'm not saying that it's good or healthy, but it has always been there and it's always been prevalent. And in the late 1990s, the sport changed dramatically for pretty much everybody in the peloton, in the pack. The speed of the race increased substantially, really for the first time in like 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
It was almost a 20% increase, and people that were, say, riding at the front were now being dropped off the back of the pack, and people were, you know, racers were scrambling, trying to figure out what's changed in the sport, who's got the juice, and how do I keep my job?
Yeah,
and I'm not condoning what he did or all of the lies that he told, but anybody that's involved in the sport has always known that this thing's been there. Having said that, you can't look at what Lance did in terms of the 7 Tour de France wins and dismiss it categorically. They are a phenomenal athletic achievement.
Especially if everybody else was doing it too. I mean, then he's still up above that crowd, but his denials were so fierce, Kevin. He was so hard on people.
And that's where I hold him accountable. It first started coming out when the Omerta, when the code of silence finally cracked, if he'd just come clean and said, look, the sport's got a problem. We've all been doing this. We need to revamp what we're doing. That would have been one thing. The fact that he beat up so many people and just wreaked havoc upon all the land, that's the part that I have trouble forgiving.
Kevin, in Philadelphia, I appreciate your call. I mean, who's got the juice was the question. It was just that it was so literal. Let me get another right here in Ogdensburg, New York. Robert's calling. Robert, you're on.
How are you doing?
Pretty well. What do you think?
Well, I keep thinking back to the 1960s when our media, you know, public television and stuff, used to make fun of the Soviet Union for doping their athletes.
And sure, a lot.
Commonplace. It's acceptable.
Yeah, it's a long time since the Soviets and the East Germans took so much heat for that. And then, you hear Kevin and plenty of other cyclists who say, but it became the norm. That was right there in the conversation last night. Oprah asked Lance if he felt he was doing something wrong, taking performance-enhancing drugs. You'll hear the back and forth.
At the time?
Mm-hmm.
No.
It did not even feel wrong?
No. It's scary.
Did you feel bad about it?
No. Even scarier.
Did you feel in any way that you were cheating?
No. The scariest.
You did not feel that you were cheating, taking banned drugs?
You know, at the time, no.
At the time, no.
And I look up, I had this exercise where, you know, because I kept hearing, you know,
that you were cheating.
I'm a drug cheat, I'm a cheat, yeah. I'm a cheater. And I went and looked up. I just looked up the definition of cheat.
Yes.
And the definition of cheat is to gain an advantage on a rival or foe, you know, that they don't have or that, you know. I didn't view it that way. I viewed it as a level playing field.
I didn't view it as cheating. He's looking in the book. I mean, Daniel Coyle, you write in your book, The Secret Race, you say, you know, EPO stimulates the creation of oxygen-rich red blood cells, boosts performance by maybe 5%, or according to your book, you write, roughly the difference between first place in the Tour de France and the middle of the pack. I mean, if you're in there to compete in a time, I don't know, if it was like baseball's steroid issue where it was all over the place and you wanted to win, was there a choice, Daniel?
No, there wasn't. And the story we tell in the book is Tyler Hamilton reluctantly, after about 1,000 days riding in the pack, at that era, as Kevin, the earlier caller, mentioned, mm-hmm. there was a fork in the road. You either got in or you got out. And once you go down that road, once you start putting something in your veins and you get great results from it, not just good results, but like the fountain of youth, like a fresh start. You've never felt so good on a bike.
Yeah.
You don't go back the other way. But that moment where Lance says, I didn't think I was cheating, is really, I think, where this story connects in a cultural way to what's happened on Wall Street, what happens in Washington, what happens in any place where there's a corrupt culture. Because cheaters, when they in a corrupt culture, everyone feels righteous. If you don't know what the people next to you are doing, if it's all in the shadows and there's this juice that they're taking, when you put it in your body, you are leveling the playing field. You're noble. And that's how you feel. In the book, Tyler tells a story of the first time he took drugs. It was like a badge of honor. That's how that culture was, and that's how all corrupt cultures are. Cheating becomes a positive for that moment. It becomes nothing. It becomes the opposite of cheating. And so we can't really attack the problem in a more basic way, in a more structural way, until we begin to understand the psychology. It's all well and good to see Lance Armstrong sort of crucified with, you know, bring out the torches and the pitchforks.
Yeah.
But this story is bigger than that, and it has to do with the psychology of corrupt cultures.
In a corrupt culture, everyone feels righteous, but surely there were times it was hard to feel righteous. I mean, earlier this year on 60 Minutes Sports, there was an interview with Travis Tigard, head of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, and Scott Pelley there asked him about personal threats made to riders who decided to come clean, and to Tigard himself.
I wonder if there were any threats against you.
There were, Scott.
These threats came from where?
Emails, letters.
Anonymous.
Yeah.
Can you remember any of the lines from the emails or the letters?
The worst was probably putting a bullet in my head.
Did you take that seriously?
Absolutely.
The threat of a bullet in the head of the anti-doping agency head. Wow. Brett in San Diego, California. Brett, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, I was saying earlier to, I don't know who it was that I was talking to earlier on this call, but, you know, I've raced bicycles in Europe. I'm roughly the same age as Lance Armstrong. I'm now an executive in the cycling industry. And, you know, I've been listening to what was being said on the phone. And the thing that I struggle with, in fact, I struggled with greatly the other day when I read Christine Brennan's article on the cover of USA Today, is that, you know, people are acting so quickly to call Lance Armstrong the worst cheat in U.S. history for sports. I don't believe it. You know, I think that yes, it is part of the Tour de France culture. It's certainly been in other parts of cycling, but there's a lot more at stake in the Tour de France. And in order to get to that level, you have to be a phenomenal athlete. You know, Lance isn't a fraud. He was a smart business person. Who got wrapped up in the heat of the moment, and he did a lot for the cycling industry that we all benefited from.
Brett, you're very generous in San Diego. We got a break coming right here, but Karen, how does that strike your ears? Lance wasn't a fraud after what we've heard last night and for years.
Well, I think he raises a point that we shouldn't look at this as an either or situation. Obviously, as we've talked about, he did win. But he wasn't exactly who he said he was. He sold himself as a person focused on health and focused on healing, and didn't turn out that way.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Lance Armstrong's big confession, what it says, what it doesn't, what we really heard with Oprah. Daniel Coyle is with us from New York. He's followed Lance Armstrong for years, author of Lance Armstrong's War, and with Tyler Hamilton of The Secret Race, Inside the Hidden World of the Tour de France, Doping, Cover-Ups, and Winning at All Costs. Karen Sternheimer is with us. She's a professor of sociology, University of California, follows celebrity culture very closely, celebrity culture and the American dream. There are deep roots there into a lot of people's psyches. Lots of response here online, Daniel, Karen. I mean, you know, Burr writes, Lance epitomized the current sports culture inundated with doping.
Many athletes make themselves believe that hard work, diet, discipline, countless hours of practice, just can't compete with the easy road of doping. Roberto says Armstrong has a massive narcissistic personality disorder, super high-functioning mental illness. He infected his team and all of us. You know, turn him off, and maybe we can all get well. John says, listen, enough already. He says, I have a hard time getting upset about Lance and his doping when we have our entire U.S. financial system cheating and lying on a daily basis. Says, Lance is small potatoes, getting way too much Oprah time. But Isaac writes, I hear you, but consider that there are millions of youth that idolized him, millions of cancer patients that were given hope by his beating cancer. All true. Oprah asked Lance Armstrong if there was happiness in winning, knowing he was taking banned substances.
There was more happiness in the process, in the build, in the preparation, in the winning was almost phoned in. And again, I don't want this issue of performance enhancers to, again, to me, that was, we're going to pump up our tires, we're going to put water in our bottles, and that too is going to happen.
It was just the way the world worked. Let's go to Connie, calling from Williamsville in New York. Connie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
I want to say, I've been listening to your show, and Lance Armstrong reminds me of the gentleman that wasn't unhappy that he stole, but very, very unhappy that he's being punished for it. And I think we live in a society where we all suffer in silence over all of these issues that have come up. And Lance Armstrong, I believe, listening to Lance Armstrong, he wants to race again. I mean, his goal is to perform again. And when I listen to his apology, that's what it sounds like to me.
Oh, what?
He's not really sorry that it happened.
Just enough to get himself out there and performing again. Connie, I appreciate your call. Daniel, what about what's at work here in those terms? I mean, a lot of people are observing this. Lance Armstrong apparently wants to get back into athletics, into triathlon competition. Does the interview play a part in that? Is he laying out sort of, steps on rungs on a ladder back here?
Well, if he did, he's doing it in a very sort of ineffective way. You have to look in Lance's personality for an answer to this. This Oprah interview started when he had a meeting with Travis Tiger, the head of USADA, about coming forward, about confessing, about giving information about others and helping clean up the sport.
And this is after the anti-doping agency came out last summer with this 1,000-page report, really scathing.
That's right. This is 1 month ago.
Uh-huh.
1 month ago, they had a meeting. It ended with Armstrong telling Tiger, you don't hold the keys to my redemption, I do, and hurling a profanity and walking out. Armstrong is fueled by defiance, and going on Oprah was kind of an extension of that. That's why he's there. He wants, and there's something, I don't know if it's not good or bad or anything, but it's just sort of who he is. It's almost childlike in its purity. He just wants to shut those guys up and get back to where he was. And so it's and also at other times
he'll
show a little bit of redemption.
But don't they have the keys to his return, or what does it depend on formally?
They in fact do. I mean, what they can possibly do if he cooperates is reduce his ban to 8 years, which means he's a 50-year-old triathlete, right?
Yeah.
But if you look deeper, this is really about Lance's identity. To compete in races where there are crowds and a finish line and clocks is so wrapped up in who he is. And so his challenge now is to try to create a new story, create a new identity. And it's going to be a long, tough road. One of the most forgiving people that I've talked to, oddly, of all this, America's reacted pretty negatively to this, to what happened last night. But the one guy who acted maybe more positive than anybody I've talked to is my co-author of The Secret Race, Tyler Hamilton, his former teammate.
Mm-hmm.
Who's been threatened by Lance, who Lance told him he was going to make his life a living hell a little more than a year ago. But because he understands, he said, this is a huge, huge step. It's a step. And the admission, yes, it's a mountain of truth. And yes, he's only shown us 10% of that mountain. But this is a step, and it's just it's psychologically it's incredibly difficult. And Lance's big mistake, I think, last night was to perform this high wire act in front of millions, and not do it in private.
Well, Terry, not doing it in private. You mean with the anti-doping agency?
That's right. He could go to them and testify under oath and tell the truth and accomplish a lot of this. You know, this idea that you need to do it in front of the American people is crazy.
Terry writes us on Twitter, says, taught my 7-year-old about how lies grow and how destructive they are with Lance as example. Mm-hmm. Coming clean early is always better. I mean, certainly last night he says he wished he would have been more forthcoming when the anti-doping agency came out with his big report last year, at least, you know, retrospectively. Oh, why didn't I come forward? Here he was with Oprah.
To go back to that moment, I would say, guys, give me 3 days. I'm going to call. And again, this is in hindsight. I wish I could go do it, but I can't. Let me call some people. Let me call my family. Let me call my mother. Let me call my sponsors. Let me call my foundation and tell them what I'm going to do. And I'll be right there. I wish I could do that. But I can't.
Can't go back. Karen, here he is, giant figure. It's like turning an ocean liner, I guess. Once you've got such a big narrative that you've fought so hard to build, people get in trouble. People tell lies. It's hard at some funny level not to have sympathy for a guy caught inside such a gigantic deception here. But then on the other hand, I don't know how self-aware he was at the time. He certainly didn't say, let me call my mother, let me talk to some friends, and then I'll cooperate with you. He did the opposite.
You know, it's really, I think, in a way sad, but instructive, as one of the emails wrote in about how the wheels are coming off of his persona. You know, one of the things that struck me, and I remember watching his Oprah interview with Sheryl Crow and kind of the persona that had been developed, that he was this great guy. And now we see the angry side that I'm sure Daniel had known about a long time for his research. But I think the American public really didn't see that side. And it is really interesting that he decided not to testify, but first go to Oprah, which kind of demonstrates his interest in trying to rehabilitate his image with the American people, maybe not doing such a great job. But, you know, I think people, and part of the angry reaction he's getting is that people really, on the one hand, are open to having their emotions manipulated in that we want to feel something for people in the public eye. We want to connect to them in some strange way. But when we feel like our emotions have been toyed with, it's really difficult to, as you say, turn around that ocean liner.
But we don't want to be cruelly unsympathetic. I mean, he did have cancer, Daniel. He did come back from that. He said with Oprah, you know, that he kept wondering when using testosterone, you know, maybe because he lost a testicle in that testicular cancer treatment.
Right.
And he was saying, you know, maybe I need a little more. I mean, did that ring true to you? You know, a guy saying, well, God, maybe I just don't have enough to accomplish what I want to accomplish here, you know, sort of portraying it as a just compensation.
Right. It rang true as a portrait of a guy whose ambition was so massive. That's the thing that distinguished him. And where this, I think, culture of celebrity, this idea of this kid from Plano, Texas, who's going to, you know, as Dr. Ferrari told me once, Lance wants to eat the world. That's a heck of a thing to say. And it's true. He kept growing and growing and growing and growing the story. And he was sort of trapped in this vortex in a way. We can think of it that way. He benefited from the vortex quite a bit, to the tune of about $125 million
yeah.
to becoming a worldwide idol. But at the same time, this symbiotic relationship between our desire for inspiration and hope and a vehicle for that, and his desire to be that guy, was just this weird match between him and America. Our own America's disease is this idea that we need to create these people, and who sort of inevitably turn out to be less than we thought, and then they come back down to earth. And that is a very unhealthy process, and it both parties play a part. I mean, certainly as a journalist, I can look back and say, we all should have done a better job of spotting this before it got quite so big. And those of us who did spot it and try to tell the truth were, in most time, met with disinterest, because stories are addictive. They talk about doping. Stories are the ultimate doping. A beautiful, inspirational story is like a drug that infects the brain of the entire country and suddenly renders us a little hazy with our vision, a little slack with our judgment, and a little eager to accept these stories that, in retrospect, are obviously too good to be true.
A very potent mix. But then, you know, you add in, here he was standing up for cancer patients
And everybody knows one, and everybody's got one in the family. Our genuine emotions were here, too. Kenyatta is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Kenyatta, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is the second time in my 40 years on this earth I've ever called in and actually got through. So
you're welcome.
A lot of people say they're nervous. I'm like, that's true. I'm actually kind of nervous, but I just wanted to weigh in on the topic.
Yes.
I'm a brain tumor survivor. I had the great blessing, I like to say, of participating in the Live Strong Challenge in California. Raised money for it and have no regrets now that I'm learning about what has taken place. But I just called because I just want to encourage people who feel let down by this man that I don't feel let down. I feel like I did something good by raising money for what I believe and I still think is a good organization. And because I don't put my faith in man and all of my chips in one basket, I put my faith in God. I just feel like, you know, right now I forgive him. I think right now he's probably feeling a lot of shame and guilt. And if he's not, then, you know, that's between him and his maker. If he believes in a higher being, which I do. So I just want to encourage people to forgive and we've all made mistakes. I believe that we were all standing at the edge of a cliff and we talked about the thing that we did that was wrong and we stepped over. All of us would, I don't know if this makes sense, but all of us would step over the cliff. I mean, I don't want to pass judgment on anyone because I don't want anyone to pass judgment on me.
Kenyatta, we've got it. You're a very generous spirit. And I think in all of this, the effort that's been poured into support of cancer patients through Live Strong, I mean, nobody wants to discount that. That's real, and that is a beautiful thing. And yet, you would hope you wouldn't have to be forgiving the guy kind of right out front with it. But I see that generosity, respect to it. Thanks for your call, Kenyatta. One more, Marie in Wakefield, Rhode Island. Marie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm also a cancer survivor, and I have a different view.
Okay.
I see this no longer as a matter of Live Strong, but Live Wrong. I didn't see Oprah, but in listening to your show, I heard a clip of him asking that why would he put chemicals in his body after he had, you know, so many chemicals through cancer and surviving.
Yep.
And he said, why would he? And I think that leaves a lot of us, especially cancer survivors, asking that very same thing. And it just leaves us sort of confused as to, you know, who is this person? And at this point, there are so many agencies that you could give money to fight cancer. I think people can rethink that.
Not Live Strong, but Live Wrong in your eyes, Marie. And it's easy to see how one comes to that conclusion, too. I'm going to get one more on this front. Lots of cancer survivors calling. Marie, thank you. Tyler in Somerville, Massachusetts. Tyler, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I am also a cancer survivor, and I'm also an endurance athlete, so I guess I can relate to Liz a little bit in that way. And I guess I'm kind of struggling to reconcile the good and the bad that I see in him because I've been following this both as an athlete and as his humanitarian side.
Sure.
And I love what he's done with Live Strong. I mean, he has donated like hundreds of millions of dollars to cancer research. But at the same time, like everything I've seen about his athletic life, his personal life, the more I've watched him come out here with Oprah, he just seems like a sociopath. It seems like he won't admit anything wrong. He's admitting the bare minimum. And for me, that's really hard to reconcile, and I'm not really sure kind of how to balance those two things.
Yeah, everybody, I guess, especially if you're a cancer survivor and an endurance athlete, those questions have to be on your mind. Oprah asked him in What Was Aired Last Night if he would cooperate with the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. Here was Armstrong.
There was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Again, I can't call for that. I got no cred. If they have it and I'm invited, I'll be the first man in the door.
The first man in the door. Daniel Coyle, you must shake your head a little at that. I mean, in some ways, he's the last man through the door here.
He's been the last man through the door for a long time. No, he hasn't been cooperative. And so to say that he'll be the first one in is disingenuous, to put it mildly. And it goes back to your caller's point. How do these two people coexist in the same body?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he really did, you know, as the callers show, he changed the narrative about cancer from being a patient to being an athlete. You know,
yeah.
The patients began to think of themselves as, which is a really powerful
fight and thrive. It was beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. And that goes on. I mean, that was sort of a fundamental meme that went out in the world, and really people grabbed onto it and are still grabbing onto it, and it's still effective. But I think we have to realize that these two people coexisted in the body, and those two people sort of fueled each other. You know, every good thing he did fueled the dark stuff and vice versa. So it was this sort of strange symbiosis between the good side and the bad side. You don't have to look at it as two people, but you look at it as he really fully was both of those things, which is why we're so fascinated by this man and why we're still talking about him.
Karen, do you see a celebrity survivor here, a comeback kid? Do you see the potential for that or not, given the dynamics of this man, this story?
You know, this is a really tough one, because in a lot of cases where people confess to something, if it is so totally, totally different from who we thought this person was, you kind of have to start from scratch. You know, when Charlie Sheen kind of had his moment a couple years ago, it wasn't too out of his character, at least the way that we saw his character. So it, you know, it wasn't that hard for us to
sort of what we expected from Charlie Sheen, only more.
Yeah, or I'm thinking former President Clinton. It wasn't as outsized. But we all have a separation between our public and private self. And when they're this disparate, it's really hard for the public to reconcile them and to accept them back when we find out there's such a big difference.
Public and private and truth and lies and inspiration and its opposite, all there in this Lance Armstrong story. It gives us a lot to think about, a lot to chew on. A lot of people recalibrating and listening closely. Karen Sternheimer, author of Celebrity Culture and the American Dream. Karen, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And Daniel Coyle with Tyler Hamilton, author of The Secret Race. Really a great book. Daniel, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
This is On Point.